Welcome to the Carl Andrew Record Club, a music podcast from the rights to Ricky Sanchez. A very special episode today as we talk to Dave Hawes of Dave Hawes and the Loved Ones about the Sing Us Home Music Festival, which happens the first weekend in May in Philadelphia. Before we get to Dave, our very own Mootloo also singing some people home as you go back out on tour. Some dates solo, some dates with Amos.
Yes, indeed.
What are you doing?
So, I'll just kind of go down the... And by the way, this was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation.
I mean, so much fun. Such a cool guy and has just such great insight on music, on touring and everything. And this festival is really exciting. So, you guys are in for a treat for this one.
But absolutely.
I'm going to start going down the list right here. We'll just
All right.
So, April 20th at Lititz Shirt Factory in Lititz, PA. That's a last minute thing I just added. It's right near Lancaster, a cool place. I played there once before, kind of listening room vibe. Friday, April 26th, at Coda in Cleveland. This is my first time ever headlining in Cleveland, so we'll see what happens. But if we got Cleveland folks, come on out. It'll be fun. Saturday, April 27th, at 20 Front Street in Lake Orion, Michigan. Another great room just outside Detroit. Sunday, May 5th, at the Middle East in Cambridge. Boston, basically. And it's in the smaller room in the corner bar, kind of also there. These are all mostly listening room shows, me and a guitar, intimate spaces. Sunday, May 19th, Eddie's Attic, one of my favorite places, in Decatur, Georgia, Atlanta, basically. So that's always a fun time, great room. Friday, May 24th, at Cafe 11 in St. Augustine, Florida, just outside Jacksonville. I've actually been to this room. I saw G-Love play there years ago, and it's a really, really cool place. First time really headlining down in that market. Thursday, June 6th at the Stoltz Listening Room, which is a small place in Easton, Maryland, just not too far from Baltimore, D.C., kind of that general area. It's a smaller space inside the Avalon Theater. And then I hit the road with our pal Amos in late June, the last week of June. June 21st, we'll be at the Auditorium Theater in Chicago. Saturday, June 22nd, at Holiday Park for the Rock the Ruins in Indianapolis. On Monday, June 24th, at the Pageant in St. Louis. Tuesday, June 25th, at the Uptown Theater in Kansas City. Thursday, June 27th, at the Astro in La Vista, Nebraska, which is basically Omaha. And finally, the last date with Amos on that run is Friday, June 28th, at the State Theater in Minneapolis. Excited. That's going to be a great time. Amos and his band, we always have such a blast out there. And then I will be announcing more dates, so maybe we'll do another round of this a bit later in the year. But one other date I have towards the end of the summer is August 10th at a really cool place called Hey Nani in Arlington Heights, Illinois. So that's the full gamut. So I know I always love seeing people when I'm out on the road who listen to the car or listen to Ricky. So I hope to see some of you lovely folks out there.
And mootloosounds.com. Links and tour dates and all that kind of stuff if you didn't have a pen, which is the best way to do it, mootloosounds.com. As I mentioned, the Sing Us Home Festival is coming up May 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Philly, Venice Island and Manayunk, which is a place that we talked to Dave about, which I didn't really know very much
it's
about.
It's kind of a hidden little gem, it seems like.
It's a really cool festival. It's the second year of the festival. On the lineup, it's three nights, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Langhorne Slim, Amethyst Kia, Dave Hawes, Laura Jane Grace, and Dave's brother Tim on Friday. The Jayhawks, full band Dave Hawes, so Dave Hawes and the Mermaid, Laura Jane Grace, Tim Berry, Sook Daniels, Space Cadet, Fishtown Choir, and Ocean Avenue Stompers on Saturday. And then on Sunday, the Loved Ones, which is Dave's legendary Philly punk band, Strike Anywhere, Sarah Shook and the Disarmers, Fire and the Radio, Mercy Union, and Ocean Avenue Stompers. And the Ocean Avenue Stompers are going to be like going through the crowd during the entire thing. Dave talks about that in the interview. So once again, singushomefestival.com. Without any further ado, Dave Hawes and the car. Dave, that's Moot. I don't know. You guys have never run into each other, I guess.
No, I guess we haven't. And which is, it's peculiar because I feel like I've heard your name on WXPN's airwaves. I mean, just, I don't know, maybe a million times.
It's the same. I've been aware of you for a long time. We know a lot of the same people, But we somehow we've never crossed paths. But good to be doing it here now.
We needed Spike. All this
yeah, we needed Spike. He was the catalyst.
Connector. That's what they call me. That's what that'll be on my headstone. So
you know
we're
recording, man.
Oh, go ahead.
I sat down. I'm gonna just out myself here.
Okay.
I've been very busy. Okay, and I have not had a ton of time to watch the Sixers and to delve into Sixers world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I told a friend of mine the other day who's like a Philly sports fanatic. I said, "Oh, I'm going on Spike's podcast," and he goes, "You are?" He goes, "Dude." He goes, "Like, we need to sit down." So yesterday I sat down and he gave me the like, "Here's what you need to know to go on the Ricky." And I was like, "All right." I was kind of tripping. And then you emailed me later about like, you know, the specifics of this podcast. And I texted him. I was like, "Hey, dude, now I can bug you about the Sixers and be somewhat literate." But I said, it's not the Ricky. And he was like, "Honestly, I'm very relieved for you."
Yeah. Well, it's funny the other way around too, is that, so we've occasionally had music guests on the Ricky, like Moot and I are close and Amos is close and been on there, but Mike always warns me. And we didn't start actually talking about the music on the Ricky. Actually, that is the impetus for this podcast, right?
Okay.
So what happened was during, and we're recording, is that okay?
I'll
put this all fine. Okay. So during COVID, we kept doing the Ricky, but obviously we had no basketball.
Right.
So we would do a segment. A listener had an idea to do a segment every pod where they send us an album, we listen to it, and then talk about it. Mm-hmm. And we called it the Carl Landry Record Club. And what I noticed about Mike, and what Mike warned me was, he goes, "I like music." He goes, "But I cannot talk about music. I'm not like a music guy. I don't understand it." So we would do this segment, and I would go on for like 8 or 9 minutes about the record, and he would go, "Yeah, I thought it was good." And that was like it. So we have to be very good. Like with you with basketball, we have to be very careful. So then Moot and I started this podcast like almost 3 years ago or over 3 years ago, I guess, as an extension of the Ricky, but in a place where I could talk music and Mike would be relieved that he didn't have to. So
yes, yeah, right, so. Right. Well, you got to be careful with Philadelphia fans too. You know, like if you front,
yes,
it's kind of like, you know, it reminds me of all the days in punk rock where it's like you'd see a carpetbagger come in and they'd have the right t-shirt, but there was and then people would go, "Oh, that guy's phony" or whatever.
Yeah.
And you got to be careful with Philly sports in the same regard. Yes, I am relieved. It's lovely to see you guys. And it's lovely to meet you, Moot. It's a long time coming.
Likewise, man. Truly a pleasure. And, you know, it's nice in a way. It's fitting that we get to do it here on the Carl because, you know, get right into the nitty gritties of talking about your music because it's, it's like I said, it's been a long time coming. I'm glad we have a musical context to do it.
Yeah, me too, man.
So Dave clearly was bored or something and took on something which seems like is awesome, but seems like an enormous hassle in a music festival. So at least in the arranging of it. So, the Sing Us Home Music Festival is May 3rd is May 3rd, 4th, 5th in Philly. Mm-hmm. Venice Island in Manayunk, this singushomefestival.com for tickets. I don't think I know the venue. Can you tell me about the venue a little bit? Cause I don't know much about it.
Yes. So I didn't really either. It's this beautiful little diamond in the rough. Well, let's face it. I mean, Manayunk is not the Manayunk of my childhood. It's nice. It is. Yeah. It's been gentrified. There's lots of stuff to do. There's lots of restaurants and so forth. And that kind of happened when I was in my teens. So it's a nice place to be. If you're listening and you're over the age of say 60 and you're like, "I'm not going to Manayunk," it's not that Manayunk.
Right.
So Venice Island is between the canal and the river. There's a little strip, and they went to great lengths, I guess, the city to build a performing arts center. But there's a stage and all this kind of stuff in an indoor setting, but it's pretty small. It holds about 250, maybe 300 people. So we use that for our VIP performances and, you know, our kind of, our kind of special area. You know, it's also the dressing room and so forth. Like, it's a big space, but we do it outside. We do it in the parking lot. There's cherry trees all along there. You can see the river. You can see the canal. You can see the back of the Main Street businesses. And it's pretty picturesque. It was something I was not aware was even there. But essentially, if you're going down Main Street, you turn on, oh my God, I should know this. I forget what it's the street that that Winnie's is just up from. So the bus.
Okay.
You go right down there, and that's the entryway to the festival.
That's awesome. I hadn't heard of that, but that sounds like a great spot, honestly.
It's awesome, man. I mean, it was such a success last year. In terms of, I mean, just people came, right? Like that's one of the major things that you got to overcome. And it was lovely. We had perfect weather. The Drive-By Truckers were our headliner. But really the weather was the headliner. Like it was that vibe of Philadelphians and East Coasters and Chicagoans that when spring hits and you're like, there's hope. Like that's what we were dealing with.
Yeah.
And so people had a great time from age, you know, 3 to 83. And we did take it on again to continue our goal. As you say, it is an enormous challenge.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a challenge in many ways. The obvious stuff is you're putting on a giant show and then trying to promote it, and you're going toe to toe with everybody from Live Nation to your old friends who promoted your shows, R5 or something.
Yeah.
So there's that, but then there's this and I probably shouldn't even talk about this, but there's this interior mental part of it where you're grappling with, hey, I want this to shine up as bright as I can, and I want to be triumphant in my old neighborhood. But ego is kind of the enemy of doing what we do. You know, the creative spark is always doused by ego. And so keeping that balance, asking old friends for favors, and then hoping not only do they come through, but are they going to help you promote it? Are they going to be crumbed on what time they're playing? Do they have any fans at all? You know, these are things like often I don't think about if we're headlining a show. It's like, well, I'll put my buddy's band on, you know, she's a great singer, and put them on. It's great. And we're taking the burden of the tickets. With a festival, you need everybody to kind of have their own draw and their own special thing. So it is a lot to think about. It's helped me. It's in anything, when you challenge yourself, you grow, but it's not without pain. It's been wild.
And you're putting yourself to work because you're playing all three days of the festival, right? Like, you're doing the acoustic thing, then the full band thing, and then the Loved Ones thing on the third night. Yeah, so.
Last year I think somebody told me I played 70 songs between Friday night at Doors and Saturday night at the End. And now we are at a third day. So I'm hoping to crack 100, I guess. I mean, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained on one hand. And then on another hand, you know, I'm trying to throw a cross between. Well, first of all, I don't really love festivals. We've played every festival there is, you know, from big, you know, dignified ones to really crappy ones. And at different points last year, when I was walking around the grounds, seeing people and hugging people, I was like, you know, I'd go to this. This is the rare festival I'd go to, which was a goal. And so that was achieved. But also, like, I've been to Frank Turner. We've played Frank Turner's festival a couple times, and that guy works his ass off. He is playing various records that are deep cuts and B-sides, and he's doing panels and all this. So I was inspired by seeing how hard he works and how he's essentially just an Energizer bunny. When you get there, he's up and he's already going, and when you go to bed, he's still going. And I think that was an inspiration for, like, all right, well, scalably, let's try something similar. And, you know, ultimately it's a way to, I don't know, to like celebrate where we're from. Me and my brother are from there, and I love the city. I moved away for no other reason than love, you know, like I fell in love with my wife and moved to California, and but I miss my people. And I feel like in the subsequent decade, the music scene has blossomed. Like suddenly you have like major stars coming out of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And it's talked about in the same way New York used to be talked about, or Brooklyn or something. And so in a weird way, I'm like, well, yeah, but that's partially ours, you know, like that we helped to build that. And I don't need credit necessarily, but I do see a place there where so much of my upbringing was can still be celebrated, you know. And so it's been really fun, you know. I guess you're catching me 2 weeks before we go, so there's I'm being pretty honest about the difficulties, but the joy of it is pretty, it's pretty awesome.
Well, just getting back to the beginning of it, what was the initial impetus when you, because this is the second year you guys are doing it, I believe, and well, couple things, like what was the initial inspiration or kernel of idea that came to you to do it, and then how do you go about curating it, because it's such a cool mix of people you have.
Thanks.
Yourself, Lara Jean Grace, Langhorne Slim, Suge Daniels, just to name a few, some artists that I know.
Uh-huh.
And, but it's a nice, unexpected cross-section of really cool different styles of artists and music, so what's the process of putting that together and even just that initial idea behind it?
The initial idea, I mean, let's face it, a festival, I could try to front with you and tell you it's a completely creative endeavor, but it's not, you know, it's a business. And I have this wonderful manager that was my booking agent, and he was just so good at that, that he just grew into my manager. And thankfully in California, that's a conflict of interest that you know, it's against the law. Whoa, look at those balloons.
Dude,
you know what that is, bro? It's the craziest thing. So in the new iOS, there's these like reactions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, it happened to me on a call at work once, and I said something, and I was on like a Zoom, and all that started happening, and I said, I'm not doing that, guys. I swear to God, I'm not doing that. I had no idea it was there. So anyway, yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
No, all good. It's a hoot. We're living in the future. So my manager Alex is wonderful. He really is. He's young, and so you get this devil may care attitude on some fronts, but he's also really, really smart. He's great with money. He's great with ideas, and he's really organized. This is the one thing you really need out of a manager, is like somebody who can make to-do lists, complete to-do lists, and then make more. And he's also, his own strange way is like, he loves government and small government. He loves corruption. He loves like anything you're going to run into with a music festival. And I don't mean he's corrupt. He's tickled by corruption. Yeah. And so when you start dealing
with, he's willing to challenge it.
I think he's more amused. Like, can you believe this is the way the parking situation works in Philadelphia? I mean, he's from Baltimore, so go figure. But so he, when we headlined Union Transfer in 2022, I mean, it was a classic thing where it was really triumphant. It was an amazing show, awesome. The city came out. We were feeling pretty good. And then we kind of looked at the pay, and I was making the deposit some few days later from the tour, you know, I had to take all the checks in, and I was like, is this right? And he was like, yeah, welcome to the next rung of success where you see like bigger shows cost bigger money.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're right. I know this in my heart, but man, that's tough. And we had been talking internally about, I mean, I have 2 5-year-olds, right? I have twin sons. And at the time, they were 3. And it's hard to leave them. You know, like most of our business is touring. And really, like, you know, there's plenty of other pieces of that pie. There's publishing. There's our label, which all do well when you tour. So it's not like you could go like, I'm going to take a year off and just rely on these good winnings from the label. It's like, no, the label's doing well because you're out playing for people. It's a classic old school dilemma of a musician. So he was like, look, if you want to tour less, I get it, but you're simply going to make less money, and you're going to have to put something else in place to try to build towards something. You know, you're in your 40s. in your early 40s. And he's like, I think it's a festival. I think it's an artist curated festival. And I just kind of was like, yeah, sure. Like, I mean, trust me. I've thought maybe that would be cool, but like, it's Philadelphia. There's no way, you know, I mean, I think right around then there was a festival with Jawbreaker, Rise Against, you know, the Rancid. It was like the biggest punk bands in the world were doing a festival in Philly that they canceled for whatever reason. And I can only assume it was any of the many logistics. You got a really discerning music public in Philadelphia where they're like, they'll not go see their favorite band because you picked the wrong venue.
Dude, I had to tell people, I've been in New York for a few years, and I had to tell them, like, you'd be amazed at the shows that could fail in Philly just because people are like, nope. And they'll fail in Philly in a way that honestly might not even fail in any other major city. Like, yeah, go to the TLA and see 15 people there or something.
Yeah.
You know, it is crazy.
And that's the TLA after the band has played Union Transfer and sold it out.
Right. Yes.
Like, It can be very bizarre, and agents, I've heard, you know, agents and managers and stuff like that, as we develop the festival, were like, good luck. And I was like, yeah, thank you. We were going to need it. But also, on some level, I do understand some of that. I mean, I'm 10 years removed. It has changed. It's not as territorial as it used to be. It's, you know, and so good, you know, that's great. But you still sort of have to understand that the people you're playing to are as discerning as you are as a performer, where, you know, we go like, I don't want to play there in a town where maybe, like, look, that venue sucks, but it's where everybody likes to go. Yeah, I mean, that's true for performers too, right? Mood, like, you can go like, oh God, we got to play this place in fill in the blank city, and you know, the backstage sucks and the load in sucks, but it's where people love to go. So I think, like, trying to navigate all that is really important, because from my perspective, we're always throwing a party, you know, whether it's we're playing in Cincinnati on a Monday night, or we're putting on a festival. Like, you're curating someone's night. And in this day and age, when you can go see Eras, or you can go see the Beyonce tour, or you can go see Bruce Springsteen, you got to kind of remember that's more or less what you're competing with. Like, yeah, you got to shine your own light, and you have to be you, and you don't have to ride a horse into the fucking Bowery Ballroom. But I do think you have to be aware that people are out there working, and their entertainment money is limited, and their time is limited, and it's a blessing to get to play for people. So all that is juggling, and Alex just kind of went to work. He was like, look, I'm going to look into this. He had worked a lot with Rising Sun, which is the Ardmore Music Hall, and you know, they promote Concerts Under the Stars, and Rich Carden has worked with the Philadelphia Folk Festival. He tour managed the Hooters, for God's sake. Like, this guy Rich has seen and done it all, and he runs that. Chris Perella works there too. So he put that team together, and then here I was going, yeah, but I've had R5 promote every show of mine for like 25 years.
Yeah.
Like, since I'm in Step Ahead in the 90s. And so Alex was like, well, do they want to co-promote? And I emailed them, and I was like, you guys want, here's what we're trying to do. And they were like, no, we don't want to do that. We want you to succeed. But, and it was interesting, because here you are dealing with punk rockers, you know, theoretically, but Sean and Andy were like, look, if you put on a 2-day event, and you've got the Drive-By Truckers, Dave Haas and the Mermaid. You know, last year we had Craig Finn and Kathleen Edwards. They were like, those are all headline shows at our venues. So right. It is competition. Like, do we want you to succeed as our friend? Of course. But would we rather have our calendar jammed full of all of those shows that week and a half? Yeah. And so, again, I was hit with like, oh, yeah, we're all in business. And so, thankfully, you know, they were just like, you have our blessing, but no, we don't want to, like, do all the production stuff. Rising Sun Presents, and, you know, they were like, we do. We believe in this. We want this to do well. We want to be a partner. And so they're our production and marketing team. And we have meetings, you know, every week. I'm not at all of them. Alex is at every single one of them. And we discuss everything from ticketing to, you know, I mean, every facet of the things you see. And a lot of times when I'm tuning in, you know, for the first time in a month, it's them fielding my insane ideas. Like, hey, I talked to Freddie from the Hoagie Shop and he wants to bring his kids. And they're like, uh-huh. And there'll be those ideas that I bring that they're like whack-a-moling down. And then there's ideas of mine where I'm like, hey, I'll play the entirety of our, you know, our fourth record turns 5 years old. I'll play the entire thing on Saturday for the VIP. And they're like, great. He got one, you know, and they'll be like, let's put that in, you know, let's make that an action item. And so I learned all these terms of, like, that business people have action items and, you know, I'm trying to think EOD, I'll have that ready by EOD, you know? Yeah. And so I use these terms now with my manager and he's like, oh, look who it is. You know, look who showed up, Business Dave. And I'm like, ah, I'm just, you know, so it was partially born of wanting to tour less. And it was partially, you know, wanting to do well, wanting to, like, hey, well, you know, if you own the bar, theoretically, you're going to make more money. And it was, but creatively, it was like, look, this is where I grew up. You know, this is very important to me, this place. And my brother lives there. Our entire operation is based in Philly still. Our van and our gear and our backline, our label, it's all there in Roxborough. And so I felt like, hey, if not now, when?
You said a lot of interesting stuff there that, like, I want to hit on. The first thing is that you don't like most festivals. So I feel the same way in that when I see a festival come out, generally what I'll do is see the 6 out of 600 bands that I want to see and have an urge to go. Yep. But then I think about the experience of sitting around all day through bands I don't care about in the heat, blah, 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 blah. So maybe it's just me being old, but also I think about when I did enjoy festivals, and the one that I went to a lot of times because of YSP was Ozfest. But there was always something, like, manageable about Ozfest, right? It was, you could get there at 2 in the afternoon, see some second stage bands, see the 5 main stage bands, and you're done. They all sort of, they have something to do with each other. Even if it's not direct, it all feels like the same thing. So all that is to say, when I looked at the lineup for Sing Us Home, and even the artists that I didn't know went and listened to them, there were two things that I thought, oh, this all makes sense, even though they're different. And even just the timing of it, I was like, oh, I could do this as a 47-year-old. Like, I could go to a few hours on a Friday night, catch half the day on Saturday for 4 hours, and then Sunday, you know, all of it feels like it makes sense. And as an adult, it feels manageable and doesn't feel like torture. So if that was what you were trying to achieve, I feel like you achieved it doing that.
Experientially, I don't think that more is better. I think everybody loses. I've been to these punk festivals where it's 600 bands, and really everybody's there to see the last band, whether that's the Descendents or Hot Water Music or Bouncing Souls or whatever. And so many of those bands that are further down are either paying to play or they're losing money to get there. I mean, I'm not going to say it's exploitive, but I am going to say it's a lot of the people who are in that lower tier of bands are not getting what they want out of that experience. Now, whether they deserve it or not is not the point. But my theory on that is, like, you know, I went to the Warped Tour, the early years of the Warped Tour, when it was like, I'll see Quicksand, Orange 9mm, Sublime, Sick of It All, The Goats. And it was like, like you said, it was manageable. It was like, well, okay, this isn't a 3-band bill or 4-band bill at the Trocadero. This is a lot of bands. But what they became years later was, like, it was noise everywhere on a blacktop pavement. And so you're like, ah, you know, there's no comfort. There's no shade to be had. And, you know, and that's not what this is. I think, like, for us, even early in the day, there's one band playing. There's one band. And, okay, I get it. Some people don't come at noon or at 3. And I get that, like, some of my friends are playing to significantly less people than we will. A, that's part of the game. It's part of just life. And B, the people that are there are a captive audience. And so you have quality throughout the entire day. It's not just a bunch of like shit thrown at a wall and like, oh, maybe this will work. It's all stuff that I think is cool. It's all stuff that I love. And what my thought is, there's got to be other people like me, right? There's got to be other people like you, Spike. You're probably the same age. You've been to really great festivals. You've been to festivals that were a bummer. This is more of just like a show. And here's another, for instance, you got to let necessity become the mother of invention. A second stage was going to cost us another like $30,000, right? Or something crazy like that. And my manager was like, we're not doing that. No one who can draw people is going to want to play the second stage.
Right.
So you basically are going to fill that stage with people who have a very small audience. It's not going to make up the 30 grand. And so I was like, yeah, but all these other people I want to play. And he was like, we're going to have to come up with a different idea. So what we did was, I think I was having this conversation with him on a text, watching a brass band in Asbury Park called the Ocean Avenue Stompers. And I was like, wait a minute. And so what they do is, in between bands, there are moving second stage. So like a band ends, the changeover happens, and then a brass band is pumping through the crowd doing everything from Beyonce to Ozzy to Rancid cover, you know, like all of my favorite music. There's a Taylor Swift song they're playing, you know, and they know all this stuff, Billy Joel, Springsteen, the Ramones, whatever. And so people are kind of following them and they're drinking and having a sandwich. And it's really fun. And you don't, if you're like, I don't want to hear music for 15 minutes, you can walk away, you know? So a lot of that is really me just going like, what do I think would be cool? What do I think would be fun? It's not fun to have six stages and everyone blaring a Marshall at you for 6 hours. Like even if you're the most diehard metal or punk fan, it sucks. So I think like a lot of that is why it looks the way it looks.
You know, you'd mentioned touring and sort of how that's the engine that sort of drives everything. And a lot of artists have been through this post-pandemic, because you've toured for years and years. I know you've done bigger tours. You toured with your band solo. You've done it all. What's your perception post-pandemic of the landscape, especially on the club level? I know the big shows are back to normal, but what changes have you seen? Does it seem to you like it's back to normal? I ask a lot of artists this and I get different responses, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on the touring circuit right now as you perceive it.
Well, my perspective is no, it's not back to normal. Demographics are really something to pay attention to. Hopefully, whoever you are, any art, like we have our Alex, right? Alex studies, like I said, he's into, what did I say earlier? He's interested in corruption. He's interested in demographics. And so when the census comes out, you would think it was Christmas Day. Like he loves when there's a new Bruce Springsteen record and he loves when there's a census. And initially I was like, what is going on? And then he explains to me, he goes, this many people have left the Los Angeles area for Texas, which means we can do more shows in Texas. This many people have gone to Phoenix, which means we're playing Phoenix again. Ohio has changed from this. And I'm like, oh, right. This is completely informing his decisions on where he thinks we should play. And what I found, I mean, look, everybody wants to have a triumphant show in New York City. These days, Taylor Swift can, Madonna can, anybody who plays the Garden can. But when you're trying to do 600 people in or 1,000 people in New York City, it is not easy anymore. Unless you have a 20-year anniversary of a record or something like. But think about it. People live in New Jersey. They live in Long Island. They live in North Jersey. And they've got to get a sitter. They've got, you know, they've left Manhattan for the day. It's all the things that make it like, all right, but it's just Dave Haas will be back, right? Is what goes through a lot of people's minds. Taylor Swift will not be back. You know, like she's coming. Olivia Rodrigo is going to play at the Garden. We have to see it. This is her big splash, whatever. The point is, I think you have to think often about how hard it is to live in San Francisco, if you're a working person, how hard it is to live in New York City. And I think that's a lot of what's going on. So that's a, this is a long answer, but ultimately we've decided to start playing in what people say are B and C markets. And we've been selling out shows. We've been having incredible responses in smaller places that are adjacent. Like, for instance, San Francisco, we used to do X amount of people, you know, and the show would be like full and awesome. Now, if we play San Francisco on the wrong day, it could be pretty rough. But if we play Mill Valley or two, or a show in Oakland and then a show out in wine country, it's like, oh my God, where are all these people? It's all the people who used to live in San Francisco. So I think that has really been an eye-opening thing. But, you know, playing in Los Angeles is not what it used to be. It's just not. Like, people, we were laughing. The other night, Social Distortion and Bad Religion did a co-headline tour in Santa, that came through Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is a B market at best, right?
Yeah.
It was sold out. And all these rock and movie stars were there. Because where would you rather see a legendary show? In Santa Barbara, California, or in LA, where you're like at the Forum and it's who's who and you know? So I think, again, if you think like a fan and you think, which is what I am, you know, I make the same calculations. I'd much rather drive to Oakland to see Paul McCartney than Los Angeles. People are not that different from us as performers. They're like, I want to go where it's nice and fun and cozy, and you know. And so I think that's how it's changed. It's demographics are the main thing. People moved.
I've had that conversation with people who work in sports before, actually, and it's it's less so about you. You know, I think it's really smart what you said, and I'll even, you say think like a fan, it's really just think like a regular person and what their life is like, you know.
Yeah.
And the idea, I live, you know, I work in Manhattan every day currently. And the number of times my wife and I'm, if I leave at 5 a.m. to go to Manhattan, it's 30 minutes. I don't live far, right?
Yeah.
The number of times my wife and I have gone into Manhattan for a leisure activity in the 3 years I've lived here is fewer than 5.
Yeah.
I think we saw Shane Gillis. Maybe we saw Amos once, but that was it, because it's so annoying. So much so that when Sunny Day Real Estate announced their tour, I was like, I'll just drive to fucking Philly and go rather than going into New York City. But it is a, and the other thing that you talk about is just like the life of people in terms of time and effort. These people have mortgages and wives and kids and lives, and they get how many hours per week to themselves? And everybody's trying to make a deal for these few hours and time and money per week. And yes, when you think about, like, this is a finite pie, it's finite. There's only so much time that people have to spend. Then it then you start thinking that way. What is the path of least resistance here?
100%. My wife is the mother of 5-year-olds. She's a psychotherapist. And sure, there's plenty of little shows that have come through, you know, but she's like, oh, Alkaline Trio's coming? That's one of my favorite bands of all time. I'm going to Los Angeles for that. It's on a Friday night. That's the only show likely she'll see. And she's a music fan.
Right.
And so, you know, this is a working woman with kids and a husband who travels. And, you know, and so when, again, like you said, if you think about it from that perspective, you also are able to divorce your ego from some of the process. Like, it's hard to come through a town where you used to do 600 people or 1,000 people or 300 people and have it be significantly less after a global pandemic that put your business, your mental health, your family all at risk, to roll back in and be like, oh, and there's not as many people here is terrifying. And it really was. And my manager again was like, but you're doing really well comparatively. And we just had a global pandemic. And I'm like, no, all the people left. No one comes to see us in New York anymore. And he's like, yeah, because they live in New Jersey. You just sold out a New Jersey show. And so part of it is like, I mean, I think the biggest challenge doing this kind of work is your mental game. It's making this your work, if you're so lucky to get it to be your work, and then making sure that not too much of your own personal value is attached to your work. You know, it's like, yeah. I'm me. I'm the dad. I'm the father of those two boys. I'm the wife, the husband of my wife. I'm my brother's brother. Regardless of how many people download the new record, buy it, or come out to see us at the Bowery Ballroom, that's not shit I'm going to think about when I'm on my deathbed.
Well, this may be a good segue into something that's a little more of a songwriting thing, but it kind of ties into what we're talking about. And as I listen through your tunes, and especially the later records, one thing I see consistently or hear consistently in your songs is it's a hard thing to do as a songwriter, the ability to kind of make a broad social commentary. But then whenever you do that, you tend to make it something very personal, something that's tethered to your experience. And when you speak on that a little bit as a songwriter, is that something you're conscious of? Because I think it's a very difficult thing to do as a songwriter. But for you, it seems like it's instinctive. It's almost like at the core of what you do.
Well, I think it's what makes me maybe an annoying friend, you know, like I tie everything back to that. We'll be having sports conversation or where are you going on vacation conversation. And I inevitably, it becomes sociopolitical for me. You know, I was,
you guys were like, be bad that you two should get dinner absolutely. At some point.
Yeah, we should. I mean, I think that part of that is just the struggle of being a working class person. And, you know, I have the unique perspective of like, my parents had no business sending me to private school. They couldn't afford it, but they worked their ass off to do so. Now, the Achilles heel of that is it was evangelical Christian school. So I didn't get college prep. I got Jesus prep. So the irony of that is not lost on me, but I think that,
well, if they're right, it's going to pay off, by the way. like the payoff will be exquisite if they are right. I just put that out there.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. If they're right, woo. Yeah. I am in deep shit, but, I think that, you know, those being the sand in the gears at this point is just it's like a suit. It's an old comfortable suit. You know, like I was a punk rock kid. I'm a working class kid in kind of a moneyed zone. Like I was going out to Montgomery County to go to school. I'm from Philly, right? So there's a grind there. There's like an existential question that gets asked. I'm in a Christian school, but I'm a rebellious kid. You know, I love punk rock and metal and all this kind of stuff. And in the 80s and 90s, they're trying to beat that out of you, literally trying to beat that out of you. You know, I mean, even now I'm a Philadelphia rock and roller living in the most expensive place in the States. Like I'm in Santa Barbara, California. If it was up to me, I would run screaming from here because I can't imagine ever buying a house. However, I love it. And my community's here. So all these kind of things are often on my mind. And so when I go down, when I go to write a song, it just kind of, it seeps out. It's like dye in the pool, right? Like you put a couple drops in there and it turns the whole pool, a little tinge of whatever color you put in. And I just think that's how I am, you know, like I don't intentionally do it. In fact, there's times I feel like I can taint an otherwise good natured song with a little like, oh, did you piss in the pool again with this? You know, where I just can't help but think when I'm admiring my children or cherishing them in a song, I can't help but think, but how are they going to end up? You know, the world is at war and, you know, so it's just the way my mind works, you know, for better or for worse. And, you know, thank God there's therapy.
I guess a punk, I have a punk and Springsteen question. So you think about the origin. I've mentioned on the pod a million times.
I knew the boss was going to come. It was going to come at some point in the process.
So I'm going to tie it all together. I'll give you a little background. The background on me is that I do not like Springsteen, but I seem to like every band that is influenced by Springsteen. So that is the context of it. So I think about punk music, which obviously your earlier music is punk, and I think about the origins of punk and just like Sex Pistols and the Ramones and Black Flag and the Misfits, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's so, but the way that punk music has evolved, there's so many people similar to you who, as their music evolves, and now sometimes even when it starts, it is punk music, but the root you can tell is this Heartland Springsteen-esque thing. And yeah. I wonder how that happened. It's an interesting shift to me, and I can't pinpoint the origin of it.
There's two. Number one, you got to remember how old we were, right? Okay, right. So in the mid-80s, who are the biggest stars there are? It's Prince, Madonna, and Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
Bryan Adams' Reckless is a huge smash.
Right.
So right before I get into this punk music and metal music that you describe, I was just a kid listening to the radio. And so Reckless is still one of my favorite records on planet Earth. I don't see a huge disconnect between the spirit that Bruce Springsteen writes from and the spirit that The Clash write from. To me, and I mean, now everything's flattened, right? Everything's like, that's all just classic rock.
Sure.
London Calling and Darkness on the Edge of Town might as well be, they might have as well gone on tour together.
Yep.
Back then, these were very disparate sects of the music industry. So I think a lot of it has to do with like, look, Tom Petty was everywhere when I was a kid. He was massive. Full Moon Fever was inescapable. So it wasn't that weird to like Aerosmith, Metallica, Iron Maiden, Tom Petty. Like, it wasn't that strange to me. It was all on MTV, right?
Yep.
And so that's number one. Number two, with regard to The Boss, I just think that he has kept the temple clean, much cleaner than a lot of the punk rockers have.
And
I think Taylor Swift does the same thing. I think when you are able to strip away how the production works, you're talking about two people who are completely at the altar of songwriting. That's what they, I mean, this woman does not have to make a new record and release it next month. She's in the middle of the biggest tour on planet Earth. And yet her North Star is her creativity, right? She's like, I want to make a new record. I want it to come out here. It's part of my whole plan. But you have to make songs to make records. And making songs is a vulnerable, scary, an exciting endeavor, especially when you're that size, right? And so I think Bruce Springsteen has always maintained that, whether you look at the Nebraska record or, you know, him pivoting after, like, breaking up the E Street Band at their height. Like, he's done exactly whatever he thinks is the most artistic, and with the same ferocity that Joe Strummer was acting. And I think for me, so much of punk rock boils down to The Clash. And if you listen to The Clash now, right, and you were like, if I was schooling my kids on punk rock history and I said, here's what punk rock is, and played them the Ramones, they'd get it. And they would know that there's a through line from that to Green Day. Mm-hmm. If you play them The Clash,
right,
you're dealing with world music from all over the world. And Joe was synthesizing all that in, you know, and so I always thought that was weird. As a kid, when I got into The Clash, I got into The Clash before heavier stuff, more rebellious stuff, Metallica and thrash metal and all that kind of stuff, because I was like, this is like a mixtape. You know, this is Lost in the Supermarket sounds different from I'm So Bored with the USA, you know, like, so I think those two things are crucial to understanding the Springsteen dynamic. And I think maybe there's even a third. He's aged with a lot of grace. And that's really hard to do as a metal or punk guy.
Sure.
The suit you have to wear, the way you even look, looks increasingly ridiculous the longer you wear it, the older you get. You know,
like I understand that, buddy. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You mentioned Springsteen, Joe Strummer, but just taking a broader list of songwriters, I was curious who you keep coming back to, past, present, whoever it might be, but people that you hear that time and again you can draw inspiration from, and specifically songwriters that have more of that thing where it's a personal storytelling thing, because I think it's a big part of your sound and your songs, is that who are those songwriters that you just keep coming back to, that you keep drawing inspiration from?
Like older ones?
Could be, or even newer. Yeah, but maybe looking back to the classics, maybe, I would say.
I mean, the Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen never fail to dazzle me. Joe Strummer. So those are big ones. I mean, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and all those big ones, they loom large. Sting is a huge one for me. The Police, you know, I love those bands. But, you know, I guess on a smaller level, it just depends on what's going on. I mean, I love that band Idols. That's a band that I've gotten into in the last couple of years that is just blowing my mind. Like, they are so ferocious, so creative. It's just pure energy. But it's also artfully done. It's not like, I think the thing I can start to get bored of is if I've already seen something really similar, I'm like, I don't know. Or if it lacks like lyrical, something compelling in the lyrics, I usually just move on pretty quick. But yeah, it's kind of all over the map. It's always been all over the map for me. But yeah, the ones I always come back to are probably that list I just made. And, you know, I'm just a song guy. You know, I love production. I love the ferocity of metal or punk or whatever. That is very exciting to me. But a lot of times when I go back to that music, what I find is it's a burst of energy, but there's not a song at the heart of a lot of it. With Minor Threat, you have all of it. You know, and so for me, I'm like, I go back to that. I'm like, this is great. This has always been great. These songs are great and they're played ferociously. But oftentimes, and this is, I think, why I've gone the direction I've gone, is like in singer songwriter music or Americana or whatever, like the song is at the top. And so Lori McKenna, if you go see her play, like, you know, that song has been fire tested and can be played on a kazoo and still, maintain its excitement. And so for me, it's a lot about songs, whether or not the songs have a compelling lyric and a point of view. You know, it doesn't even have to be like a great lyric. It's a point of view is typically what I'm looking for, and something that is a bit against the grain. It's at least calling something into question.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing about being a song person is, and that's one thing that Moot and I talk about, because we have definitely different like cores as to what we grew up listening to and what we like, is that you, if you're a song person, you can both listen to the same record no matter what genre is and pick out the same ones that you like, you know, is that it is above everything else. It is above genre, I think, in a lot of ways.
Now, Spike, are you a song guy?
I am a song guy.
You are? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, and that's why, by the way, I love pop music too. And
right.
And so, you know, when I was on YSP, I was a metal guy, and then I became pop guy, but it's this, I'm listening for the same thing. Now I might choose to listen to them at different times.
Sure.
You know, like depending on your mood, but it always comes back to the song for me. It always comes back to the song.
I agree. And it's so funny because what I find now, you know, the thing that's so fascinating to me about Taylor Swift is that for all intents and purposes, she's doing the job I do at the highest level you possibly can. And so you have a lot of that. That's interesting to me. You know, like, I'm like, whoa, so there's hope. You know, because all she does is sit down and put her feelings to a beat and chords. You know, that's all she's doing. It's the same thing as me. Now, once it goes from there, we are living as different lives as you can possibly imagine. But I think one thing I've noticed is a lot of people my age who have kids that are maybe 12, 15, who have had Swifties on their hands, their kids are Swifties. They go, and I go, well, what's your favorite song? You know, like if I, let's say I meet a family I know and I haven't seen them in a while, and I go, did you guys go to the Eras tour? Do you like the new Taylor record? And the kids are like, yeah, you know, anti-hero or whatever. And I'll turn to the mom who I've known for 20 years and go, what about you? And they'll kind of go like, I like Folkmore and Evermore. I don't like the pop stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is exactly what happened with Nebraska.
Yeah.
You know, people are like, I'm not into that like Heartland, Bruce Springsteen thing. But then he makes Nebraska, and it's stripped down and it's much more, I don't know, like gritty. And people are like, oh, I finally get it. And to me, I'm like, well, shit, production really is super important. You know, it most people, I think that I had a light bulb go on even on this last tour where I was like, maybe it's kind of like films where it's like, not every great film has a great story. But if you film it well and you have the great, you know, you might get a great film. And I think that's maybe the way I need to look at production more is like, look, this is the way to bring people to the song. And it's kind of changing my view on it because I'm a song guy and I assume everybody is, but it's not so. It's really not so. Like, I mean, plenty of people are, let's just say, listening to WYSP because they're working construction and trying to get through the day and it's aggressive. And like, that's the music that turns their crank and they don't necessarily care what the song is. So it's a weird thing that I'm finally like, okay, I guess I get how people are.
Well, it's an interesting chicken and the egg kind of thing. Cause I know you work solo and you sometimes go out and do kind of like listening room kind of places, right?
Yeah.
And
a lot of times.
And so have you found that the more you've done that, it's influenced your writing in a way, or even the way you go into the studio? Because that is the bare bones way of presenting a song. You know, you, like you said, if you can strip everything away. We talk about this with Spike all the time. You peel all the production away. If it's an undeniable melody and lyric and composition, it's going to hold up. And when you perform solo, that's what it is. You have to deliver it bare bones. So in doing those tours, maybe road testing songs that way, have you found that it's influenced your writing or even the way you look at the songs when you go into the studio?
Well, you know, I'm again with this recent revelation. I do wonder if that's ironing my resolve in the wrong direction where I'm like in an echo chamber where I'm like, the song works just so well this way. Let's just do it this way. And rather than think about it more from that like cinematic film perspective, I don't know. I wonder if I'm not giving the songs, you know, enough. Like, put it this way. If each song is like one of your little children and you're like, they're going to go out in the world. These are pretty sturdy kids. Like, go out. And you're not giving them any real fighting chance other than their bones. You know, I'm not sure. So I wonder if I'm like cultivating an echo chamber. Hey, is the connection okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine, and the recording will be fine. You're just the video's a little skippy, but it'll be fine.
Audio is nice and clear.
Yeah, everything's
okay. Good,
fine.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
I can also maybe here. Why don't I quit a couple of these things as we go? But yeah, I don't know. I think it helps. I think it helps understand what kind of song you actually have by road testing it and doing it solo. But I do think, you know, you got to be careful. I mean, we just did a whole tour of churches and cathedrals through Europe that was really successful. Oh, wow. It was amazing. And you're playing the room, you know, you're playing a room that was built for the very purpose of amplifying acoustic instruments and voices and so on. And so the tendency could be like, all right, well, let's just do that. Let's go in with a piano and a guitar and a vocal. I think the thing you got to remember is when people get that record, they're not in a church. They're in a car on their way to you know, they're taking their kids to school. You know, there might be a false sense of like, look at how good I am at this because you're in a listening room. You have a captive audience. Like, is that song going to cut when people are drinking and standing and haven't seen each other in a while? You know, I think it's all really, that's the weird, that's the thing we're all chasing, right? You know, like we're chasing getting that magic moment that you had that one time with that song in Connecticut or something or in East Jepip and getting it to tape. That is such a dark art, you know. It's such a tricky thing to get that.
Channel that moment basically and capture that. Yeah, because once that moment is gone, like you will always work, especially in the studio because it's kind of a sterile environment. You have to recreate that. It's not the easiest thing.
It's not.
It was funny when I didn't know Versus existed till you texted, and I was like, oh, like this will be cool. And it was a really cool record of you going back to, you know, older songs and doing them. Now, obviously you do that live all the time. Uh-huh. I wonder what it's like to go back and, think about songs that you wrote 15 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever, and what you think of them. Like, you know what I mean? Like what you think of it to go and re-record it again. Obviously so many of the songs go well live. Are there things that are like, you know, people would like to hear this again, but I don't much love this song anymore. I can't put my mind in the place where I was when I first recorded it. What was that process like?
It's interesting. It's a great question, which you are known for. It's a very incisive question in terms of the psychology of it. I would say that I wouldn't have been able to do this at any other point because, again, I mean, I think I'm a lot kinder to the earlier version of myself now that I have kids. And so I can hear these songs and not be hypercritical of the songwriter that I was on one hand. On another hand, I can also not be threatened by the good ones. Because I've made other good ones. I've had other success. You know, it's not no one. I'm in a really great situation where a lot of times when you have a band that makes a splash, you're always chasing that band. You know, like you go, so the guy goes solo, the lady goes solo, and really she's just trying to get the former glory. You know, they can never get back. You know, it's rare. The Paul Simon paradigm is pretty rare where you're like, there's some people who don't even listen to Simon and Garfunkel. It's just Paul Simon or Paul McCartney or whatever. But I'm not threatened by that work now. I've made songs that have touched people's lives. I've toured successfully as a solo guy and with my band and with my brother. And we've written songs that I know are better than some of those loved one songs. And it's not even about better, right? It's about a creative life where you're chasing the dragon always. And so I think a lot of it has to do with just being comfortable as a person. Are there songs on there I didn't want to record? Yeah. But, but I also, you know, again, I get back to my manager, Alex. Was, he had a very crass and peculiar way of describing. I was like, let's just leave these five off. Let's just say. And he was like, if you're going to be a gigolo, you got to fuck well on every single one. And I looked at him. I was like, what are you talking about? And he kind of had this glint in his eye. And I was like, I understand the analogy. And he's correct. Like, if you're going to do it, do it. Right. And so it gave me the fire to get through those last few. Or I was like, I don't know about this song. Like, I really wish I could rewrite that lyric. Or, but again, like, that's a different man that wrote those. You know, like, that's a guy in his late 20s and or early 30s and I was relying on energy. I knew the songs were going to be played at a certain velocity with a certain amount of, you know, impact, and sometimes when you take that away, there's less remaining when you pull out a ukulele or a guitar or whatever. And so it was an interesting thing. I mean, a lot of it too, don't forget, is we own those masters now. We own master recordings of all those songs. And because we started a label. And so I started to see, like, oh, this is why people start labels. And so part of wanting those songs in at least some iteration was owning the master. Like, you know, if somebody wants the lyric, you know, a clean sung version of Pretty Good Year for a movie, they don't have to go to the label that owns the master. They can come to me. And so part of that is a little bit of, like, you know, building our own ecosystem.
That's super interesting, I think. And a good answer, actually.
Thanks.
Like, yeah, for sure. And thanks to the corruption guy for making you record.
he's gonna be displeased,
or whatever it was that you didn't want to do.
He's gonna be displeased that I said that. What I mean is, he was interested in how corruption works.
Yes, for sure.
What I take away from what you're saying about how he operates, though, is he seems like a outside of the box thinker. which in this era of where everything is upside down, in just, you know, music, entertainment, whatever it might be, you need someone maybe that can look at it from this other lens that, you know, as artists, we're not necessarily going to think of things in that way. So it actually seems like a real asset in a way to have these other perspectives that you wouldn't think apply to music necessarily.
Well, my brother's the same way. My brother's 15 years younger. He's my songwriting partner. He's my, you know, best friend. Like, I mean, and he doesn't think about it the way I do. And here's the thing, though. Like you said something a minute ago, you said, as artists, we don't think about that. As artists, we do think about that. We are always trying to challenge ourselves when we make up things. We don't think about the business part that way because it used to be this way, or we used to get paid for CDs or whatever that that thing is. And I think as older people, you can allow what you know to calcify, right? You can go like, this is just how I know to do it. And why is it all changing? It's like, well, because it was always changing. And but I do think that having those two people on my team as the two main people on my team, Alex, and then of course my brother Tim, he does this for songwriting. He's like, well, why not say that? Why not do this? You can write a song about your kids that's sweet and divine, and it doesn't, you know, like everyone knows you can rock. You know, he'll say that sometimes. Like, we all know, dude. And sometimes it's nice to show another side of the things that you can do artistically. And so I think that trying to have that creativity around songs is, and then have that influence the rest of what you do in your business, you can come up with some really fun and impactful things for people who are taking the ride with you.
It's always cool for me to see you and your brother, and your brother Tim, who does solo stuff as well, which is great, and then plays in your band, and then is playing the first night, and I assume we'll play with you.
Yep.
I'm very close to my brother as well, and it's it must be really cool because I'm 8 years older than my brother.
Oh, and, awesome.
Yeah, and he lives in LA. He works for Disney, but that moment where your younger brother becomes old and wise enough to not only give you good ideas, but do it without a lot of times you get older and you're more jaded, but like they come with they're enough like you to know how you think, but enough different to give you advice to be a better you. And watching like your brother play with you is always really cool to me to see that you guys
awesome.
Are doing the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize there was that link in terms of the year gap. I think that year gap can be really hard to overcome when you're young.
Yeah.
And can be incredibly inspiring when you're old. Because look, you know, we're all trying to avoid, as you age, these neuroses from taking over. You start to let the old man in, and the old man can take over real quick. You know, and this is why you see people turn like ultra conservative as they age. And it's like, you have to protect whatever way of life you've been used to. It's like, I mean, that is just so not fun. It's just not a fun way of existing in the world. Especially if you're close to creativity and, you know, Spike, for you, you're constantly your brain and the way you process information, whether it be the sports world or you know, this music podcast, like your brain is a creative engine that's taking this information and go and creatively adding context and going, well, here's what I think about Tyrese Maxey, or here's what I think about Daryl Morey or whatever. And I think that constant engine is what you do for work. It's not that different from saying, all right, well, I want to produce songs out of nowhere, you know, but essentially you're responding to the context clues that you have around you, nature, politics, whatever, love, etc. So I don't think it's that different. I think the creative energy is beating in everyone. And so, like you say, if you've got a family member to do that with, they understand the context of how you were raised, what makes you tick, what drives you crazy. And they also want you to be the best version of a big brother that you possibly can be, even if you haven't been that. Right.
Right.
It's a trip.
Well, Dude, it was great. I don't think I've seen you since like the end of WYSP or like Loud and Local, which would have been over a decade ago, which is fucking crazy. You look great, man. You're aging well.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. Likewise. Yeah. It's wonderful to see you. And if you guys want to come to the festival, please, you will be guests of honor. And I say that with the caveat of like, I'll hug you and be like, it's great to see you. And now I have to go play 19 songs.
Yeah,
it's your
show. Yeah, for sure.
Heavy work, but no, that would be great. I would love that.
Yeah. I was actually talking to my wife about it. It's actually, I'm excited. I can go to Saturday and Sunday. I am bummed because Friday looks cool and I can't go to Friday because I have an event up here, but singushomefestival.com and the tickets are available there. It was, I wish you luck with it. I'm excited to go to it. I'm hoping for good weather too.
I am too. Yeah. Moot, you got to play, man. You gotta come play at some point.
I would love to.
Yeah. It's a really special vibe. And you know, one thing I will say in closing is one of the best feelings as we wrapped up last year was we did something that worked. And one of the best feelings was no one got taken advantage of. The fans,
right,
the smaller bands, the bigger bands, like everyone was paid, everyone was like considered and had like a fun time, and no one got screwed. And so often in the music business you walk away from a festival and you're like, the promoter kind of screwed the fans, or the, you know, fill in the blank. There's plenty of that kind of exploitive stuff, and that's something we aim not to do, and that was a good feeling walking away. We'd love to have you play and would love to have you guys attend this year and see what we're cooking up, because we're building something pretty cool.
By the way, everyone having a good time is the point, you know, which is basically like what you described. It's like everybody got their money's worth and had a cool time.
You know?
It's like, boy, what a fucking novel idea, you know? So thank you, man. It's great to see you. I can't wait to see you next month. And I'm sorry you did all the Sixers prep, but like, we'll find use for that at some other point, I'm sure.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, go Sixers. I'm feeling pretty good, man. I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah. Well, so are all. We'll make sure we get this out quick enough so that doesn't sound ridiculous when it comes out. We'll get it out in 2 days.
We're working against the clock here.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about that. Yeah,
we always are. I mean, hey, we wouldn't be Philadelphians if we weren't feeling pretty good about some sports related thing that might go sideways.
Might go bad. Yeah. All right, man. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Dave, such a pleasure meeting you, man. Thank you for coming on with us.
Thanks, guys. All the best here. Let's get one of these, right? Let's get one of these on the way out.
There it is.
Thanks, y'all.